So we're really excited to be here with y'all today. The purpose of this panel is to give you guys a sense of the diversity of careers that are available in environmental law, and I think we've got a wonderful panel to do that. At the outset, I should note that our last panelist, for those of you sitting in the room, you can see Megan Saronsky's name tag is sitting there. She'll be joining us at 4 o'clock, so we will take a brief break then to let Megan introduce herself. We intend for this program to be really informal, so we'll each take a few minutes to introduce ourselves, and then right away, if you have questions, feel free to start asking them. If no one has a question right away, I will ask some questions. But really, anything you want to ask, please feel free to do so. For those of you on the phone, a reminder to email Chris Barney. Her email is Barney, B-A-R-N-E-Y, at ELI.org, and I will make sure that your questions get asked. We will repeat all questions into the microphone, so if you ask a question and I repeat it, that's what we're doing. So I will turn it over to Amy to introduce herself.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Amy McDonald. I'm currently the General Counsel for the District Department of the Environment. I'm actually an employee of the Attorney General, but I sit with my client, which is the District Department of the Environment. So I handle all legal matters, all advise on policy matters, regulatory matters, things of that nature for the entire agency. The Department of the Environment's approximately 350 employees. We have everything from air, water, hazardous waste, to energy and sustainability programs. A lot of our programs are delegated from EPA just like a state would be, even though we're not a state. So we function very much the way most states do when it comes to EPA regulations. Prior to my time with the Department of the Environment and the Attorney General, I spent 5 years at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation as litigation counsel there. And before that, I would say the other big chunk of my time in my career has been with the Indiana Attorney General's office, and there I did environmental litigation for about 5 years. With that, I'll turn it over to Patrick.
Sure. Thanks, Amy. And thanks, everybody. Good afternoon. I'm Patrick Hedren. I work for the General Electric Company. At a sort of corporate level, we've got a lot of little different entities scattered around the country and the world, but we also have a sort of central office here in D.C. that works on issues that are corporate in nature, and environmental work is almost chief among them. And as you might imagine from the name, our mission hasn't changed dramatically from energy in the past 120 years or so since we were founded. And a lot of the issues that we're facing today, for instance, if anybody was very excited on Monday, by example, we were too. And these are issues that we need to deal with as well as we can. So we work from a policy perspective, we work from a legal perspective, and as a result, I work with a lot of teams internally to do that. So the corporate environmental programs team, I even work with the tax team, government affairs where I sit, and with a lot of our outside counsel, which kind of spans the spectrum across all the statutes. Before coming to GE, I spent time campaigning, spent some time on the Hill, and also in a different in-house role litigating outside of environmental law, so we're going to pretend for the afternoon like that part never existed. And that environmental law had my heart the entire time. But really, a little more diverse and a little less of a standard legal career post-law school. So very happy to be here, and turn it over to you.
Hey guys, my name's David. I work the closest to here geographically because I'm about 4 steps down the hall. I'm also the only non-litigator, so we don't litigate here. We're research and policy, public interest organization. So, yeah, and also, there's M&Ms from the panelists, and I'm like driving this point home because when I was in Alaska working for ELI, they said that you always have food for guests, and they had this beautiful pickled salmon, and I have fresh caught M&Ms from CVS. They were on sale too. Like I wasn't actually planning it. But yeah, so this job I knew was the job for me when I went to Alaska for the first time, and two things happened. One, I was talking to my supervisor who I was going with, and I asked her, well, what do I wear? You know, lawyer need to go be formal. She said, just like you're going to a very, very cold outdoor barbecue. So that was clear. But then the main thing was at the end of the trip, it was 2 weeks long, an elder came up to me and said that, thank you for your work, we need you here. And he definitely wasn't talking to me personally, he's talking to the organization, I imagine, because at that point I was incredibly dispensable. But it really made me realize that this role is important. So what we do mostly is in the community work, engaging, focusing on outreach and getting information out there. So I work in Alaska with Alaska Native communities, and then in the Gulf working on Deepwater Horizon restoration and recovery. And there's some funny stories there that I'm gonna omit for now to avoid, but they involve dancing, so we can talk about them during the reception. And then also on some work in Africa with some of the mining issues there. And so I'm currently, didn't even say my title, I'm currently the Public Interest Law Fellow, and I'm transitioning into a staff attorney position starting the San Francisco office this summer. And introduce Brandon.
Thanks, David. Hi, everyone. My name is Brandon Harrell, and I'm a third-year associate at Beveridge and Diamond. We're the nation's oldest environmental law firm. We have approximately 100 attorneys at this point and 6 offices throughout the country. My practice at Beveridge and Diamond primarily consists of environmental litigation. I also do some regulatory work as well at Beveridge and Diamond. At B&D, as we call it, Beveridge and Diamond, we have a regulatory practice, litigation, land use practice. We also have a huge international practice as well, where we do work in Europe. We have a Latin America practice and also a Asia Pacific practice as well. My background, I have a background in chemical engineering, which you don't have to have a science or engineering background to go into environmental law, but it's useful sometimes. I first summer with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, and then went to the EPA and did OECA, that's the Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance, stayed there for one summer as well, and then came on to Beveridge and Diamond after law school. So been there for 3 years. Like I said, since I've been at B&D, I've had the opportunity to work on product regulation matters, litigation dealing with CERCLA, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act matters, and toxic torts as well, and also some international matters as well. So it's a little bit about my background, and I guess we'll get into it more as we go on with the panel.
So I guess it's my turn. As Chris said, my name is Maggie Peloso. I'm an attorney with Vinson & Elkins, V&E, and I guess we'll try to enunciate clearly to distinguish our firms, is a really large international law firm that focuses primarily on energy work. I practice in the environmental and the climate change groups there. I came to V&E straight out of law school, and I did a PhD at the same time I was getting my JD, so my practice really focuses on all of the technical pieces of environmental law. So I do a lot of things where you need an expert witness, if you need an air modeler, those kinds of things I do, which is really fun because I get to spend a lot of time not in the office, but actually out with scientists doing real things in the world. I also help to run V&E's climate change practice, so it's been a very big and exciting week for us. I guess that's kind of it. So, I'll ask a question to start off for everybody. Tell me what you do in a typical day.
I guess I'll start off since you're looking down here. A typical day, it varies. I mean, it depends on what I'm working on. As I mentioned earlier, I do litigation. And within litigation, I mean, it depends on what stage of the case you're in, whether or not you're in discovery, or are you taking depositions, are you working with expert witnesses with scientific backgrounds, are you working on motions? That it can vary. A lot of times, working in the law firm setting, and Maggie can attest this, I guess, you come in sort of with an agenda in the morning, but you never really reach that agenda by the end of the day. You look at your list and you're like, I didn't even do anything on here. Because, I mean, you have so many different matters that come through the door and so many different things that change throughout the day. But typically, or if I'm working on a product regulation matter, it can, you know, you may be looking at regulations, or, you know, having team meetings with the client or meeting with the client to find out what issues they're having at the time and how to address those issues. So it really varies on what you're doing, whether or not you're in the office, outside of the office, which is what I really enjoy. I think, you know, being able to be a problem solver and to help your client solve their issues, I think it you're not doing the same thing every day. It's different, whether you're writing, whether you're working on your oral advocacy skills, or working on various projects with teams and different groups. I think it varies. It's a sort of a tough question there, because day-to-day schedule changes each day, each week that you work. So
I work at a public interest organization, which generally, just from a threshold point, is a little bit more relaxed with like when you get in and when you leave, so there's no like set schedule with that sort of thing. Like people arrive at different times and leave at different times, which I think is a key lifestyle. I mean, some firms are very much like that, others are not, so it's a key lifestyle difference. But then from a substantive point of view, it's a lot of dealing with people. And so we have teams within the organization, all these different projects I talked about, golf in Alaska. And so we have different deliverables that we do. So we're not litigating, but we are generating reports and all the things that you hear environmental nonprofits do. But a lot of it, too, is just trying to see what the community members need. So calling community groups, talking to them, getting their input. Yeah, and then throughout the day, kind of just responding to what comes up. A lot of what we do is trying to be very quick and responsive to what's needed that day or that week or that month where we work. So yeah, that's most of it. And then I'm usually able to leave early enough and get home to my puppy and that sort of thing, which is also really nice.
I'd say for the large part, I would echo that. No standard day, and I think you would hear that pretty broadly through the profession, that a practice can drag you in so many different areas that it's kind of tough to predict. But I'd say, you know, for me, a little more in a government affairs role, you do get a seasonality to it that I think that you have maybe a little bit less of in the private firm setting, or you know, the issues that you deal with certainly never stop. Whereas for us in August, you could skeet shoot in our hallways, I think, if you wanted to, and we get back and kind of scrub the graffiti off the walls and kick the people out and come back in September and start working again. But there's heavy seasons too, the budget season, in times in which bills might pass or major regulations going through. Recently, 111B and 111D have made life very exciting and full of hours like that. But in a typical day, I'd say out of, you know, 12 to 16 hours or so, I'd probably spend 4 to 5 reading the stuff that you guys write, the stuff that you all write, and making sure that I'm keeping up with what's going on, because at this point in the game, this is a field of law that's moving so quickly. And it's very responsive to the political realities on the Hill, and it's responsive to the states and everybody who's a player right now in this kind of changing landscape, especially in air. And so I try and keep up with that as much as possible and take the time off that I can when possible to kind of stay sane, which is a key part.
But Patrick, do you want to explain for those who are not airheads like us what 111B and 111D are about?
Oh, sure. Sorry, you kind of live with these long enough and then you figure you can talk to your mom about them. But it's a set of regulations designed to regulate the standards of performance for new and existing sources. In this case, EPA is working through those for power plants, electric generating units. Principally, this means gas and coal. There's a lot of type of units that, you know, emit carbon, but those are the principal among them. Dealing with how do we get to a future that has some guardrails around how much carbon we're putting into the atmosphere, a future in which the U.S. is a credible player at the international stage, like next year in Paris, where they'll again try and hash out an agreement globally for regulation of carbon. But right now, these are the principal tools we've got with a locked-up Congress to actually try and do something about climate change. And so these are hugely influential rules, and EPA is a hugely influential agency, as are all environmental agencies, that get to regulate a sector so deeply and specifically. And my company happens to produce a lot of equipment, especially on the gas side of the equation. We're really not on the coal side, but there is a lot of implications for the grid, for reliability, and for a lot of other aspects that we either sell into or we deal with or our customers deal with. So those are the big movers, but they've been tremendously exciting rules because of the potential that they hold for actually creating meaningful reductions in carbon emissions in the country and driving renewables integration and sort of the where we need to go rather than where we've been.
I don't know if I could ever describe one of my days as typical. So being the general counsel, like I said, I touch almost everything that comes out of the agency. So my day can involve, and I also carry my own caseload as well. So my day can involve dealing with one of my own cases, whether it's drafting a motion or brief or whatever it may be, to reviewing a brief or a motion that another attorney that I supervise has drafted before it gets filed. I some days review regulations, help draft legislation, daily advice to all the programs. Sometimes, you know, tell them what they want to do is either legal or illegal. Daily advice to the director on a whole host of issues. Developing the budget that actually comes through my office as well. So it's, you know, it's varied by the minute in my office. It's really hard to say typical, but I pretty much touch everything that comes out of the agency. And with the air issues, we're really involved in those too, as are most states, because of the impact it has on states that have non-attainment zones and things of that nature. So we're involved in a lot of the multi-state litigation cases that deal with the air issues. So I handle all of those as well.
Thank you. Okay, first question from the telephone audience. How should an attorney who's been practicing for a few years, but not in the environmental field, try to break in?
So, I can just start with a little story. So we have she's right down the hall, but we have an attorney here who's a bankruptcy attorney in New York City, one of the biggest firms, for 5 or 6 years, and was on partner track and all that when she decided that it wasn't for her. I mean, she had kind of known all along, but to complete 180, have never been exposed to environmental work. And she immediately went to ELI and volunteered her time to demonstrate the interest. Because I think the hard part is, you know, why are you interested? Like, if that's not where you were in the past. And so she worked without pay for 6 months, proved herself, and she was just, I mean, she is outstanding. And now she's been a staff attorney here for 5 or 6 years and is fully integrated in everything. But I think you have to put yourself out there and take a risk and invest in your own work and be confident that you can go help someone pretty much as like a high level intern for a little bit. And, you know, especially from mid-career people, that's so valuable to an organization. And I think that's the way to get in.
To echo David's comments, he mentioned one key thing, which is to demonstrate interest in the field. I think there are two main ways. We have partners at our firm who came from different backgrounds. And I think one is to develop a skill. For instance, if you have a litigation background, if you have a criminal background, you can break into white-collar matters, environmental white-collar matters. If you have a transactional background, I mean, there's deals all the time in the environmental sector. So if you can develop, if you have a skill, you can kind of have the skill develop and it'll transcend to the environmental field. The second part would be, as David mentioned, is to have a demonstrated interest in the area, whether or not it's start writing articles on environmental issues, start working with nonprofits or even volunteer. You want to get that on your resume, get some sort of interest in environmental on your resume so that you can demonstrate that when you're trying to break in the field and show that you have an interest in it, that you have been working in it. And if you have that, and if you also have worked to develop a skill, you should shouldn't really have a problem with breaking into the field at all, at least in my eyes.
I would say also it's important to not overlook academic settings. You know, I hate to tell people to go back to school, but when I was in law school, I had a fabulous clinical fellow who had practiced as a litigator at a top national firm for 5 or 6 years, and she came in and she was the fellow in the environmental law clinic, and she taught us all discovery, and we helped her learn environmental law along the way, and I think it was a very productive relationship for everyone. I think also increasingly you're seeing law schools establish environmental LLM programs as well, which is another option, but you know, there are many ways to do it without more school, getting involved in organizations like ABA or anywhere else that has the opportunity for that. And if you're at a law firm and you're relatively new, some firms will allow you to transfer departments. So we've had attorneys in our department who started as energy transactional attorneys and after a couple of years said, you know, the part of this I really like is the environmental part and I want to move over full time.
I might make the shameful admission to say that I never took a class on environmental law. I never took a class in administrative law. Two big regrets in my life. And it turns out that that's almost all that I do in a normal day, and came to it through a roundabout way. So I'd say I wouldn't worry too much about not beginning from exactly the right place. I think that's dead on, that I think there is room to grow, switch, and work in places adjacent to energy and environment, of which there's many, and find an in through there. And I'd also agree that having an interest and demonstrating that interest is critical as well. One of the ways that I'd suggest to do that, and this is not typically a community that has a trouble with doing this, but is to get engaged in a campaign setting and to get engaged on the ground moving these issues, because the reason that we have these laws is because some person either voted or didn't vote in some town in Iowa or Nebraska or California. And really that on the ground work or on the ground work campaigning for an environmental cause can help make that show that demonstration to that and open up doors and build your network and get you more integrated in these topics.
I don't have much to add. I would echo the showing the interest. I mean, that's huge. I know when I review resumes for attorney openings, I get a lot that don't have any environmental, legal experience, but I do look, do they have an interest, or have they done something at least that shows me that, that they're serious and they're not just, trying to take any job that they can find. So I would agree.
And to build off that, I mean, there's opportunities to do it in a less formal setting too. Like ELI has a lot of different things you can go to, boot camps, both on the East and West Coast, things like that that can be on your resume to show the interest without necessarily investing a huge amount of yourself into it right away. But at a certain point, you can take that even to the next level and keep moving up. I mean, with anything in life, you just got to go both feet in at some points.
The boot camp is great. We send all of our new attorneys to the boot camp each year, at least the one here in D.C. It's great. You get to learn about whether it's the Clean Water Act, CERCLA, they have different sessions on each statute, and I found it very useful when I went as a first-year associate. So I think it's a great thing.
Totally agree. Take full advantage of what ELI offers, because it's actually a phenomenal way to meet people, to meet the issues, and those boot camps are same experience.
So I want to pick up on something that Patrick said and ask our other panelists, is there something you didn't study before becoming to your current job that you wish you had?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. I think for me, I went to Tulane, and we have a pretty good environmental law program. I didn't take environmental enforcement, and I think that would have been very useful to my practice right now. Just kind of understanding, although I did summer with the EPA, but understanding how enforcement works, what the government is looking for, what their goals are, and typically how the cases tend to operate in that setting. I mean, I'm learning now, but I think it would have been a useful course to take up the time and to come in with that knowledge. As I mentioned, I haven't mentioned this, but Jim Patrick mentioned that he didn't take environmental courses, correct, in law school? Right. I know a number of people that practice environmental law that didn't take environmental courses. I don't think you have to, but I think it can be useful. But I also still highly suggest also taking some of your core courses as well. I mean, I took a number of litigation courses, admin law. Those are all useful courses that will help you in your practice down the road.
So, I'm kind of the opposite of Patrick. I took they call it doctrinal, like the big major classes of law school. I kind of took the anti-approach and took the bare minimum of that and took all the environmental classes that were offered. So I took animal law and brought a dog into class, that sort of thing. So it was a very different experience, but my philosophy kind of isn't, I think it varies a lot, but you're pretty much going to have to learn all this stuff on the fly anyway. You're going to study for the bar, and the amount you learn it, you learn how to take law school tests in law school, and you learn a lot about the subject, but never enough to practice. And so if you're comfortable with that uncertainty of having to teach yourself a little bit and go into the bar exam a little bit unprepared at first, I think law school is a great place to expose yourself to very interesting ideas about environmental law that you really are not going to see elsewhere. That being said, if you're dead set on litigating, you should probably take evidence, admin, and all those main courses in addition to animal law.
I I would say, for me personally, I wish I would have taken a little more on the energy side of things. I was very focused on the traditional environmental field, which is what I've done most of my career, and it's been wonderful. But now the energy issues are really coming up. So, for instance, when I was at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, I spent several years dealing with fracking issues because of the Bay watershed. And now I deal with a lot of energy, a lot of utility issues. I mean, Exelon just announced that they're going to acquire Pepco Holdings. This is something I now have to deal with, being the general counsel of the main agency in the district that's going to deal with this. So I think for me, I kind of put the energy aside and didn't want to deal with it, and now it's, you know, rearing its ugly head. So I, you know, that's something. But yeah, I would say kind of along the lines, though, of the most important thing, I echo what you said, that, you know, you don't necessarily learn how to be a lawyer in law school. I think the most important things are the research and writing. No matter what field you choose, you have to be a good writer. There's just no way around that. So I would focus there, and on trial advocacy if you want to be a litigator, things of that nature.
Yeah, and to build on that, like, I think a lot of that comes from mentors. You learn from other people as opposed to a way it's taught. So really seek out, like Megan Saronsky, who's not here right now, she was my supervisor my first summer in law school, and the best teacher ever. She never like specifically taught me anything, but just being around her and learning from osmosis, and that's something that you can seek out in law school. Like if a good teacher teaches a class, it does not matter what that class is, be in it, get to know that person, and really just engage.
Any questions from the audience here yet? No one's feeling brave?
I just have a question regarding the types of clients you have. I kind of feel like different firms and different companies, you have some very different clients, I guess, who you're working with.
Sure.
Could you kind of give us details about and what you're doing for them?
Okay, yeah, so the question for those on the phone is what types of clients we work with and what we do for them.
Me?
Go ahead. Anyone.
I'm the easiest one. The government is my client, so it's pretty easy. Although, even within government, you sometimes get, you know, struggles. You know, whether the agency wants to do one thing, but a sister agency, you know, wants to do something else. So it's navigating that. But on a daily basis, I have the same client. It's the government. So I don't really get a choice in who my client is.
I think that's a great question. And I have a stranger answer probably, because I am a client and I have different clients basically within my company. You'd think it would just be, you know, the General Electric Company, sort of full stop, that's my client, and in a true sense that is the case, but really within, we've got 8 businesses that would usually be a Fortune 100 company, and they each feel a certain way, they each have a certain culture, and they each have different divisions of responsibility within them that really need to be making the decisions that we need them to make when we're engaging on the formation of regulation. And I have to kind of translate that in a coherent and sort of conclusive way to make sure that nobody's toes are getting stepped on too badly, or that wishes are contravened, or that we're not ignoring somebody who has a valid concern in a different part of the business, and then work with our outside counsel to do that. And it's complicated for them even, because for them, who exactly within the company the relationship is with or where their relationship runs can be kind of a tricky thing as well.
Well, we have a broad range of clients, whether it's a major oil and gas company, pharmaceutical company, and we work on different issues for each of these companies. We have municipalities, for instance, in the project development realm, helping with environmental impact statements. Also, if it's an electronics company, a major electronics company that we represent, whether or not they can sell their products in Europe or Asia, and how do they dispose of those products, sort of from cradle to the grave process, advising clients on that end, or whether it's defending an oil and gas company or a defense company on groundwater contamination, or whether it's just an issue, a Clean Air Act issue where the local or state government or the federal government has an enforcement action against them, or to prevent the enforcement action. Even helping some of these major clients with white collar matters as well, whether or not it's a criminal investigation or just the government's coming in to see, to make sure they're complying properly with the regulations within the city or within the state regulations. So we have a broad range of clients, as I mentioned. It can be, you know, some of the Fortune 100 companies all the way to people at the firm that represented strip malls, owners of strip malls on certain matters. I mean, as far as dry cleaners, they have environmental issues as well. So it's a broad range of clients. It just depends, you know, day to day it can be an issue. Whether or not I've worked on the matter in Uganda, it can be in Uganda, or it can be right here in D.C. It's a broad range globally. But so it's sort of hard to just narrow it down to one type of client, but a good range.
Now for something completely different. So Megan, who is going to come later, is with EDF. So public interest, they're funded by donations. Probably some of your parents or even you guys donate to EDF and that sort of thing. So they represent the public. That's their client, which is an interesting mandate. For someone like ELI, we're mostly grant-based, so you're given certain goals and indicators and that sort of thing on behalf of the public, but you're, at the end of the day, reporting to your grantor. So, for example, the work in the Gulf on Deepwater Horizon is funded by the Walton Foundation, so Walmart pays a good bit of my salary, and which is great. I mean, they do amazing work down there, but it's an interesting client to have in that regard. And then a lot of the other work is just government, so NOAA will contract out with us and that sort of thing.
So we represent mostly large mining and oil and gas companies. That's principally what BNE does. BNE does a lot of work in the transactional space, so in addition to some of the kinds of litigation things that Brandon was talking about that we also do, we represent a lot of big banks and investment companies that are doing things like buying and selling power plants, which is a sort of different side of the practice, but it's actually really interesting. So I think this next question's for me. I'm going to read it, and if any of y'all want to jump in first, I'll be happy to have you do so. The question is, what does a climate change practice entail? Anyone else?
Well, I mean, I think we all probably touch climate change at a certain point, especially, you know, you at GE.
To a degree.
So, I mean, for me personally, it involves the litigation that I mentioned, you know, the multi-state air cases. It also involves the sustainability office. You know, we have a big office in the district dealing with sustainability in the district. One part of that is dealing with climate change and how it's going to impact the district. And so it's a lot of advice on that and, you know, figuring out which studies we need to do and things of that nature. So
I really see the climate change practice, at least from the private sector side, as having two really distinct facets to it. There's the stuff that everybody's really focused on right now, which is EPA regulating greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act, which looks a lot like traditional Clean Air Act litigation. If you're in law school now and you want to be a climate change lawyer, I would recommend to you that that's probably not a career path you want to pursue, unless you just want to be a Clean Air Act litigator, because I think in a lot of ways that's going to fold back into normal Clean Air Act work. The other piece of a climate change practice deals with how do we carry out our business, or how does a governmental agency that regulates carry out their regulations when environmental conditions are changing? Right, so if you have a major facility like a port that's got to be on the water, but sea levels are rising and your port's going to go underwater, how do you deal with that? There's clearly a lot of policy questions around that. There's a lot of regulatory work there. There are some really interesting and complicated legal questions that arise. There are really interesting questions for the EPA on how do you structure permits so that your permitting regime makes sense when environmental conditions change. And so that, I think, is where the real growth in climate change work will be.
And when Megan comes, we should ask this question again, because she's like one of the preeminent people in this field. So.
I think it's very interesting. Once again, I keep calling out Patrick over here, but I know a lot of corporations now are, a lot of eyes on the corporations as to what they're doing to address climate change issues. One very interesting recent event was back in November of 2013. Congress called in all of the major sports industries, the NBA, the NFL, NHL, MLB, even the U.S. Olympic Committee, and had them testify as to what they're doing to address climate change, even in the sports industry, as far as building the development of their stadiums, the equipment, the lighting, I mean, just what they're doing and what they plan to do in the future to address climate change. And a lot of the sports industries have been considering climate change and with the ways that they're going to address it and how, you know, how it impacts their industry in the field. So it's not just sort of the litigating end of it as well, but you touched on how it's impacting corporations and what they have to do as well. But I think that's a big thing that's in the public eye right now that's pretty interesting. And it can be from any industry, as you can see, whether it's sports or whether it's energy or a electronics company, what they're doing to it.
Right. The military is dealing with it, too.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of the military, the big Navy bases, Virginia, you know, down in Norfolk, it's one of the largest bases, and the military is really starting to look at what's going to happen with climate change and sea level rise and, you know, certain islands sinking and things of that, what it's going to do to their fleets and their, so I mean, right, everybody's dealing with it.
Right. Not to mention the geopolitical issues with it, too, when you start having, you know, a changing landscape. I think, I'd maybe even give almost three answers. I think there's part of my job that's company focused, that's internally focused, that's advising a client. Part of a job that's issue focused, that's making sure that we're not, you know, we're a big company, but we can still get squashed like a bug under a regulation because we're dealing with way bigger factors than ourselves. And a part that's people focused, and this is sort of across all three of those. And I think the advising the client part, GE Capital does invest in energy products and invest in power plants, midstream infrastructure, both in the U.S. and abroad. And what does it mean when we're dealing with, you know, management of water resources, for instance, around power plants? How does that impact the calculus of how to invest? And what's the likely policy response? What are the opportunities that come up from something like retiring the San Onofre plant, which is a big nuclear plant? I think like 2 gigawatts of power in Southern California, and you have one community arguing that it should be entirely renewable and battery replacement, and another part of the community arguing that that should be the opportunity to put flexibility in the grid. And also people focused and making sure that we're integrated with the community of people that work these issues, because it's increasingly important as they start moving quickly that I think everybody sort of knows who each other is to an extent. It's maybe a more government affairs-y answer than a legal answer, but there will be players on the Hill about this. There's certainly some that have been in the past that are moving on now, and some that are sort of coming up, but figuring out who the people are that'll make a difference on these things going forward.
Any more questions in the room? Way in the back.
Just from curiosity, I have a question especially for the ERI. So how do you see, well, you practice law and environmental law, but how do you see that different from, you know, conventional study, you know, like research organizations or NGOs that do like advocacy job for like environmental energy?
So for us, the big thing that sets what we do apart is that we're nonpartisan, so there's no advocacy element. Oh, repeat the question. Basically, it was asking what differentiates ELI from more traditional nonprofit organizations and which engage in advocacy. So because we're nonpartisan, we don't represent an interest and advocate for them. We try to present information and let the information advocate on its own. So in certain areas, like in the Gulf of Mexico after Deepwater Horizon, you know, BP is not our enemy at all. Like, we want BP to be very happy with what we put out because it's true. But at the same time, we want communities to be able to use it to, you know, if they deserve money from BP, to get it. And that sort of thing. So we're basically trying to use the law to make it work for people and to make it work for companies, because you know, that's what the nonpartisan reality is. And sometimes reality has a little bit of bias on its own just by the nature of the facts. But yeah, so that's what sets us apart. And what sets us apart from someone like EDF is that we don't litigate. And you'll see some of that at places like Ocean Conservancy or things like that. But not litigating opens you up a lot to people don't have a combative posture when you deal with them, because they're not expecting, there's no you don't really have that hammer behind them. So we can talk to both sides and have full in-depth conversations and hopefully help people out by, you know, bringing them together. Thank you.
Other questions? Go ahead.
I'd just be curious, since you have such different paths, what you find to be the most fulfilling and the most frustrating aspects of the particular path that they're on.
Well, I'll repeat the question if I have this correct. It was, since we're all in on particular different paths, what do we find the most fulfilling about our paths and sort of the most frustrating portion of our path? I think the most fulfilling is that, you know, I love what I do. You know, I had an interest in going into environmental law from undergrad. And, you know, I work at, as I mentioned, the oldest environmental law firm in the nation. And, you know, each day I get to work on environmental issues, which, you know, I really enjoy. I think the demand of what we all do, you put in a lot of time, a lot of hours. But when you love what you do, and it's, you know, every day the issues are changing, it kind of cross each other out a bit more. I look at it as it's a lot of hours and a huge demand, a lot of time on my end. But when you love what you do, it kind of, the days fly by. I mean, I'll look up sometimes and it's, you know, 6 p.m. and it's like, wait, I need to go home at a certain point. But you're enjoying what you're doing each day, and it's a new project and there's new issues each day. So I think, you know, if you find it fulfilling because, one, you're doing what you love, two, especially when you can help people. Yes, on my end, with the working at a law firm, you represent some corporations, and you're trying to help corporations in the sense address climate change issues or build projects or help help them comply with the government regulations, which you know, you can find fulfilling when you're able to solve a problem and help someone or help an industry solve their issues as well. So I think that's the fulfilling portion of it, and it's not really a bad thing. That's a lot of time and a lot of hours. But if, like I said, if you love what you do, you find it fulfilling. That's kind of not an issue.
So I think the fulfilling and frustrating part for public interest jobs generally kind of stem from the same thing. So the fulfilling part is the creativity aspect of it, that, and the responsibility aspect of it, that I started as a fellow this year, and next year I'm moving to San Francisco to start the California office for our organization with one of my coworkers. And that's just so cool and so exciting, and that really can only happen at a public interest organization that's resource strapped. And with that too, creativity to think of new directions where you're given a lot of responsibility right away, because there isn't a pyramid above you that you have to work up for 10 years. And you know, part of that's just the people you get to deal with directly all the time. And I think we're all probably going to say that, your coworkers, people, that's great. But then it's not frustrating for me, but I would say across most public interest organizations, you're paid a good bit less than at some private places. And so that's a consideration that a lot of people take into account. I mean, I think usually it should never be what decides it for you, but I could imagine people being slightly frustrated by it.
Yeah, it's sort of like a raise your hand if you have student loans. I echo what they both said, and I think, I don't know, there's moments that I love what I do, and it's usually something to do with a moment where you see some true creativity come into the field, and we're at a point in time where we've got this basically 1950s era statute, like the Clean Air Act, that's been dragging on through history, and with a stop off in the 70s and in 1990. In fact, I have an ELI desk book from 91 that was a hand-me-down from somebody who sort of pitied me at one point. So hey, you should have the statute on your desk, and it hasn't really changed all that much. And there's really only creative thinking left to do. So like the 111 rules, that's not really how anybody in D.C. wants to do it. And in one of these miracles of modern Washington, because nobody in the city wants to do it, that's exactly what we're doing. And that leads sort of the frustrating part. Maybe it's a little too cute to say the frustrating part is 3 miles due east of here, but it is a little bit frustrating, and sometimes you come up against a brick wall. I would venture a guess that, you know, my
colleagues in the private sector at ELI and others faced frustration, maybe to a greater extent, when it comes to brick walls. Like, if you're being forced against, you feel like you're getting railroaded, or if you're on the agency side, you feel like you can't crack through and you can't understand quite why it won't catch, but you're right about the case. But, you know, I'd say it's in those moments, you remember, that nobody comes into this field thinking, I want to do the maximum amount of damage to planet Earth that I possibly can do. What's the most dangerous place for it to be? Everybody pretty much wants to leave it in better shape than we got here. Otherwise, they would have picked M&A, for example. You know, pick your poison.
Explain the acronym.
Oh, mergers and acquisitions. Sorry, it's sort of like the classic Gordon Gekko side of law that you know, a lot of us come into law school wanting to do, and then realize maybe not M&A, but. But I think that's, you know, that joins the two for me. I think, you know, the people and the issues are fascinating, and they're incredible to work with, so I enjoy it. And I don't feel particularly bad about late days either, for whatever reason. Probably drives my wife crazy, but, you know, I feel fulfilled.
Yeah, for me, you know, I think one of the most fulfilling things is just the number of issues I get to deal with on a daily basis, more than I could have ever imagined. So. You know, it's pretty exciting to walk in and think, I don't know what's going to come across my desk today, but whatever it is, I'm going to have to figure it out and solve the problem. So that's pretty fulfilling. That can also be one of the most frustrating things, is the sheer volume of issues that I deal with. You know, sometimes I'd like to spend more time on something, but I just can't. So I think that for me, you know, I'm a litigator. I've litigated my whole career. I do a lot less litigation now that I'm general counsel, just because I can't. And so I think for me that's a little frustrating, is I miss the amount of litigation I used to do.
So for me, the best part of my job is that I'm always learning. And Brandon has said a bunch of times, you don't have to have a science background to come into environmental law. But if you happen to have one, and you go to a law firm, you will find that you may well be in the minority. And what tends to happen then is people go, oh my gosh, you know science. Like science is a thing. So my graduate training in marine biology and ecology has made me the person to do geochemistry, toxicology, mineralogy, all kinds of things. And I love it, right? Because as opposed to if I pursued a career in the sciences where you just get narrower, narrower, narrower on what you're doing, I get to work with people who are at the top of their field and continue to learn all of these other things. And that, for me, is the most fun part of the job. I think a common frustration in a bigger law firm, especially if you're somewhere that's not specialized just in environmental law, is that especially at the junior level, you might not have a lot of control over what you work on, right? So you might just be super interested in some rule that's just come out, but if it's not something that your firm's clients are interested in, especially when you're junior and you're not really in a position to go out and get work on your own, you can still engage with it. You know, you can write articles, you can learn about it, but you're not necessarily going to be working on those things.
Which is very different than government.
Yes.
Because of the resource issue. You get thrown in right from the get-go, so you do get to work on a lot of those issues.
You have a question?
Yeah, I'm curious if your firm or if the government or your business has a client or an actor or some sort of job you're working on, you don't necessarily agree with, independently of the job, some more that you don't agree with it, how do you work on that?
So the question was, is there something that's come up in your work that makes you morally uncomfortable? I suppose the question is, you don't agree with it as an environmentalist.
Yeah,
and how do you deal with that and continue to work on behalf of that client?
Well, once again, I'm going to call Patrick out again. We represent a lot of corporations, a lot of companies, and you get that question often, pretty often, from, you know, various law students or just anyone in the general public. But overall, as he mentioned earlier, no one really wants to do damage to the earth and leave it damaged. I think all of the clients that I've worked with since I've been at Beverage and Diamond, as I mentioned, it's been, you know, Fortune 500 companies, oil and gas companies, transportation companies, defense companies, pharmaceutical companies. I haven't come across one client that wanted to come in and do damage to the earth. I think everyone wants to either comply with the regulations or figure out how they can avoid doing damage to the earth. So it's not all, I haven't run into those issues. It's more so how can we avoid having this done or this happen? How do we mitigate it, clean it up, and make sure and kind of restore the land or restore the property to a level where it's not going to be contaminated or to where it won't affect the public? So I think I've always come across issues as how can we, you know, either prevent this issue from happening or how do we clean up this issue and prevent it from expanding or spreading. And that's been my experience in my practice. I mean, everyone has come in and just they want guidance or they want help on how to prevent it from happening or how to kind of fix the problem.
Yeah, I would say for me, I've had it happen a few times, mostly with enforcement cases, whether an enforcement case wasn't brought against somebody or was brought that maybe shouldn't have been. And so, I mean, the best you can do is advise your client, you know, what legally what the options are, since that's our job, is to give them the legal advice. Sometimes you can try to interject your personal feelings. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I mean, the fact of the matter is you have a job to do, and that's advise your client on the legal issues, and that's what you do. And you know, if it's something that you're really morally opposed to, usually you could ask that somebody else be assigned to it, whether it's a different associate or a different partner or, you know, a different attorney in the office. And most of the times that'll happen. But, you know, like I said, we all have a job to do, and you need to do your job, you know.
Yeah, I agree. And I would say my answer is much less than you would think. When I run into this, it was a huge industrial concern, right? You'd think they'd be everywhere, but generally much less than you think. And I would also echo, I mean, to me, the job of lawyer has always been that zealous advocate for your client bit. I didn't think it was quite as much about the bar and the sort of details and the accoutrement that came with it. But the fact that you represent your client, even if they have some warts, and there is an opportunity in a company setting, certainly, and I think in a government setting, to interject good judgment and try and advise your client on what a good course is. I have absolutely come across issues that, personally, I think I would wish they'd go a different way, but I understand why the company fights this out, and I also understand that there's other factors engaged with why this issue might not be quite as black and white as I think. And I also think there's an element to which you have to use sort of critical theory to look past what the statutes we have do and are, what the regulations do and are, and look at what's the broader picture and how do we get there. If it's a matter of fighting over the emission limit for a particular pollutant that really, in my opinion, is not the hill you want to die on, depending on how you feel on it, because there is a bigger picture there. And it's not, you know, these issues are not solved and not won on a case-by-case basis. It's a whole long sort of trajectory.
So I just want to remind folks on the phone that if you have questions, please email them to Chris Barney. Her email is Barney, B-A-R-N-E-Y, at ELI.org. Does anyone else in the room have a question? Okay. Show of hands, how many of you clerked? None of us. Well, then my question would be completely irrelevant.
But there are benefits to clerking. I have coworkers who have clerked, and they come in with a wealth of knowledge, especially in the litigation end, just knowing the rules of civil procedure and how courts operate and what judges are thinking and what motion to put forth and how to write and how, as Maggie mentioned earlier, writing is important. How to write, how to be an advocate for your client. I mean, they get to see it from behind the bench and what the judge is thinking. I find that a very, very invaluable skill or knowledge base to have. So I wish I would have clerked, but I didn't. But I think it's a great thing to do.
And I think Megan clerked, so maybe we can
ask her about it.
Grinning, maybe not, but I think so.
Yeah, I think the writing point. It seems like there is no better training than a year of getting your butt kicked by a federal judge to get you a better writer. But it is really the critical skill. I think I hope that everyone would agree. But you know, for somebody, if you have a case with Amy or somebody else, like she mentioned, there's not a lot of time in the day at a certain point. And when we're dealing with, you know, elected officials or high government officials,
really, you know, some courses give you a page limit for a brief. We try and keep it to about a page, if we can, and boil it down. If you want to dig deeper, that material's always there. But the skills that come with that, I think...
And the research skills.
From my colleagues that have clerked, seems to come through pretty strongly.
Yeah,
so
my husband clerked, and he's one of the best researchers I know. And it's because that's all you do, is research and write.
Right.
So since none of us clerked, what did you do to improve your writing skills after law school?
Well, for me, I started out with the government. I was at the Attorney General's office in Indiana, and there was four of us to cover all the environmental litigation for the entire state, so we got thrown right in. So I would say for me it was just practice by filing briefs from the moment I walked in the door. And then, you know, having seasoned attorneys help you in proofread things. So, you know, when I had to file my first appellate brief in the Seventh Circuit, obviously, I went to somebody who is in the appellate practice to help with that and make sure that, you know, I was doing what needed to be done. But for me, it was just practice.
Yeah, I agree. And for me, maybe the Hill, where you've got this guy, you know, God knows where he is, he might be a committee, and you need to let him know what an issue is or who feels what way about it, and you can do it in about 5 seconds. That gets you to be more crisp writer. But I think having a chance, in my case, coming into GE, I was matched up essentially with one other much more senior attorney who had been a partner at a firm here in DC and had been through the White House twice and federal clerk and all the sort of one of those legal resumes that you should like frame on the wall, you know, Ninth Circuit and all that. And having that mentorship and the ability of somebody to go through it, and it's sort of a rare ability, I think, to get that in the profession now. But that certainly helped me to have somebody to say, too many words, less commas, more point.
And I think being, to build off Patrick's point, is being very responsive. Like when you have someone that will look over your stuff, to not shy away from edits. Like, I mean, I'm sure all of us have had things that you get back and it looks like confetti, like in terms of like with all these different colors and markings. But to not be scared of that, like people have visions of what you might not agree with all of that, but once you see how other people work and think, it'll make you so much better. And, you know, along with that, whether you're in a litigation setting or not, is to be comfortable telling a story. I mean, I think people that can write outside of the law can write in the law. So if you write a blog, that's great. If you are just comfortable telling a joke, that's great. Things like that matter, even though you're not going to be telling a joke in a brief, hopefully. It does. And also just letting your voice come out. Never be a jerk, that sort of thing. But
I agree with everything that's been said. Overall, once again, writing is important, and you should always be trying to get better and better at your writing skills. I think overall, I would say to seek out writing opportunities. That's one thing I did, whether it's with a bar organization or within a firm. We have the Toxic Tort Quarterly that we put out from day one. You want to seek out writing opportunities so you can work on your skill and work on your craft and get better. Even once you get staffed on matters or cases, be aggressive and be willing to take the first draft or be willing to write the first draft. It may come back red line, looks like blood all over it. But I mean, that's someone who's critiquing your writing who's been practicing for 30, 35, 40 years, who has seen a number of briefs come across their desk, and you learn from that. I mean, you look at what they've changed. One thing I do is if I volunteer to take the first crack at the first draft, I'll look at the draft that I have, and then I'll look at the finished product, and how did it change, and where did it change, and why is this much better than what I did? And you want to constantly work on that and get better each and every year. Another thing is you can take writing courses. I recently took Brian Gardner's legal writing course, and I found that very interesting and very, and learned a lot. I mean, he's a great writer. One, seek out opportunities. I think you can always seek out opportunities. One thing Brian Gardner did say was, read legal writing books. There's all kinds of writing books. notebooks out there. You can go on Amazon and find some for really cheap and, you know, used ones and just, you know, look at different styles of writing. You know, everyone has different styles, but you can learn from each style and kind of create your own or learn when to use a certain tone and learn when to scale back a bit more. And I just think keep constantly work on it and seek out opportunities, whether you're trying to get published or writing for a bar organization or any type of organization. I think that's also a great way to practice and develop your skill.
And just building off that, like, the final product is probably going to be very different than whatever you started with, like, very different, like, discouragingly so, but it doesn't mean, like, that's something to be comfortable with and to embrace, because even when senior people start, or even when senior people draft, it will end up being different. And to, you know, I know a lot of people are pretty successful throughout their lives that get into law, and but to check your ego at the door whenever you can.
There's kind of a balance to strike there, actually. If I'm, you know, working for Amy and I'm sending her a document, I need to get it there on time, certainly so that you can look at it. And but at the same time, so, you know, don't be too concerned, I think, on one hand. But the other hand, I don't want to cut the ribbons and more work for somebody higher level to have to review and go through.
Right, I don't want your first draft.
Yeah, exactly. But there's a balance in there, and it's sort of, you know, well, keep writing all the time and get better and better and better at it. And you will kind of naturally start to get there, too, where you can build that trust relationship with your...
Keep it simple.
Yeah.
You know, don't overcomplicate it. That's the biggest thing that I have with, especially, like, younger attorneys that come in. They try to really overcomplicate things sometimes. And it's really that when you look at the issue, you can make it pretty simple and still get your point across. And I think that's a big thing to keep in mind. You know, you don't have to always have a brief that's, you know, 50 pages long. And if you've given a 50-page limit, which I don't know anybody who would give you, any judge that would, but you know, you don't have to use the whole page limit.
Yeah.
Keep that in mind, too.
I guess along the same lines, I'm just curious for all your colleagues or the applicants you see, are there, besides sort of writing and research, which we hear a lot about, are there any specific skills you sometimes wish people had, like a language skill or a particular practice area skill or an intramural sports team skill? Or just what sort of things stand out to you that you sometimes wish were there that aren't?
So the question is what skills we wish our colleagues had?
Or applicants.
Or applicants for jobs.
Just anything that kind of stands out to you.
For me, what I look for is I look for someone who's interested in environmental law, first and foremost. Hopefully they've actually practiced environmental law, but if not, at least if they have an interest. I look for a good writer. I actually do read the writing samples that I'm given. So I look for a good writer. I look for somebody who I think can be a self-starter, but at the same time isn't afraid to ask questions. I don't want to hire somebody, especially somebody new, who thinks that if they come to me with a question, I'm going to hold it against them because they don't know the answer. I want you to come to me because I don't want a mistake to happen that's going to cause problems down the road. So I want someone that's confident enough to say, hey, I don't know what I'm doing here. You know, you just told me to file a TRO. I don't know what that means. You know, it's a temporary restraining order like that. I want you to be able to tell me that. So I look for those things. I look for somebody who just in general has a lot of ambition and who isn't afraid to put in the hours. You know, a lot of people think, oh, you work for government. You work, you know, 8 hours and go home. It doesn't work that way. And while I don't expect you to live there and put in, you know, 16-hour days, I do expect you to, you know, work hard while you're there. And so a hard worker is really important to me.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. I think I maybe look for a little different things. And actually, we've been going through an application process in the recent weeks here. Just taking a lot of my time. But I think the law firms maybe look for the, you know, very eminent people coming out of law school, and I think grades are critical, and I think experience is critical. Clerkships can be critical. We don't necessarily have the environment where that is a critical success. We don't have to sell our associates to the businesses of why they're there. And so what I look for is definitely writing, thick skin, because it's not easy to go through that and get that feedback. And on the one hand, you know, if you are becoming a lawyer, this is one thing you just have to deal with, that there's going to be some it's not going to be a totally smooth road, but how you handle that, and if you can kind of, you know, pass what I call the Cleveland Airport test, you know, could you get stuck at the Cleveland Airport for 12 hours with somebody without going nuts, which is good. So having interests, having having something else, and being that type of person that isn't going to shy away from asking questions, is going to be a good team player. That stuff is critical, more so than the degree and the GPA and the clerkship and whatnot.
Yeah, I've always heard of that referred to as the China test, if you're flying to China with a person. But I feel like Cleveland Airport is significantly worse.
And unfortunately, a little more denigrated to Cleveland. So I apologize to any Ohioans, but...
Yeah, I guess on the fence, especially. So I was kind of expecting that type of question, and I think it's a great one. So I asked like two of the top people here and got pretty much the same three answers. So one is that you enjoy working with that person, which is something that can come out in your resume really loud and clear. I mean, I've reviewed a lot of them, and basically, you know, your interests, and not your like interests at the bottom, but showing that you do have a personality, and that, you know, you are the numbers on the, like, to a certain extent, but that's not all you are. So then confident in that person's abilities was the second one, and I feel like that's a little bit more your traditional resume thing. One thing that is an option for a lot of people, especially if you haven't applied to law school yet, is to consider doing a dual degree. A lot of places have, you can get environmental master's degrees, and it doesn't really add that much time, and it's a good way to demonstrate interest, have a lot of fun, learn cool things, and a lot of schools have that. But then, you know, that's your typical resume stuff, which is tough to build, and it kind of just, it falls into where it plays. But then the other place that Patrick mentioned is being a team player. You know, being there for your coworkers and your interviewers, and just having people know that you care about them, and that you're a self-starter, you make sure they won't fall beneath the cracks too. Like, junior people also have responsibility in that regard, and to just basically be a full person as much as you can. I think there's a tendency in law, and maybe it's more like this at top law firms, but I know in public interest it's not, like, there's a tendency in law to kind of be a suit, and the suit isn't what gets you hired, it's the personality there. And I think that's, like, probably all you guys would be really fun to have a beer with, and that, or, you know, non-alcoholic drink of your choice. But that, and that's something that, you know, you can show, and you can show in a lot of different ways.
It is, and if I could just say one thing before you go, that's, I will tell everyone, the last question I always ask everybody in an interview is, tell me one thing about yourself that's not on the resume. And that answer tells you an amazing amount of things about that person. And it just, like you said, it's not the suit. It's that answer can tell you a lot of things. So.
Yeah, I echo everything everyone's been saying. I think for us, you know, having a demonstrated interest in environmental law is important. But, you know, when I review resumes, you know, generally we get a lot of applications from people who have a strong interest in environmental law. So it's coming down to, okay, their writing, you know, they're looking at their experience and what they've done. I think going beyond that, since a lot of people on the panel have already touched on some of the main things, the first things I look at, some of the important matters. I look at also, you mentioned foreign languages. You know, we have a Latin American practice. So, you know, being able to speak Spanish, you know, that's huge. I mean, that's an asset that you bring to the table. We have a presence in Europe. We have a presence in Asia. I mean, if you can speak a foreign language or have experience in those areas, we find that very beneficial to us. But also, as they mentioned, you know, whether it's Cleveland, China, anywhere in the world, I mean, if I'm traveling with you, I want to actually kind of enjoy your company and be able to work with you on a team. I mean, I think seeing if that person can be a team player. I sit on the recruiting committee for the firm, and I'm the most junior person actually on the recruiting committee. So in general, I look at it as, do they fit into the firm culture? As far as the associates, I look at Beverage and Diamond, I think we have a very collegial atmosphere. And, you know, does that first person fit into the culture? Are they going to be a great team player? Do they want to be here? A lot of people will say, hey, a partner of a firm, he says, it's like dating. You know, do you want to be with us, and do we want to be with you? I mean, you want to be a perfect match. You don't want to be with someone you're not interested in, because it's not going to work out. So is that person really interested? You know, do you have a demonstrated interest in us, in the firm? Do you want to learn? I mean, you can look at a resume. You can have someone that went to, you know, a top 10 law school, who clerked, had a top GPA, and then you can have someone who, you know, went to a good law school, wasn't at the top of the class, but wants to be there, that wants to learn. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of it you're going to learn, you know, as you practice and on the go. You learn generally how to be a lawyer as you're practicing. And if that person, you know, has the hunger and the want to learn and to get better, I may take that candidate over the person with the top GPA that, you know, clerked and everything else that they're not really interested in. I don't get a sense that they want to be here or they want it that bad. So just showing that you're really interested and that you want to be there, knowing about the firm, knowing what we do, having done your research on who we are, and also on the environmental field, and bringing other aspects to the table. The question of that Amy mentioned of, you know, tell me something about yourself that's not in your resume. That's a tough question, because it's, you know, the first second you're thinking like, oh my gosh, let me think of something good, interesting that they may find interesting. I mean, but you know, if you're an interesting person, I mean, we can be from two totally different backgrounds, two totally different cultures, but you know, you may bring something to the table that I know nothing about, but I'm interested in, and you know, that's cool, we bond there. So it's something good to be well-rounded, diverse, and just, but also, you know, as we mentioned, having an interest in environmental law, good legal writing skills, a strong interest, good oral advocacy skills, those are all important as well.
And yeah, I totally agree with all that. And kind of building off that, and I know it's Megan's here now. And so after my first year, I worked like a million rungs under her at EDF in Boulder. And
we don't have that many employees. I could not possibly have that million rungs.
I created a lot of rungs. But she was the type of attorney and the personality that like I aspired to be, and her and Vicki Patton, who was her supervisor. So I think she's especially qualified to answer some of your questions. So.
Oh gosh. Well, thank you, David. And hi, everyone. I apologize for being extremely late. I had a conflict come up that there wasn't anything I'd do about it. So I'm really sorry. As Chris can tell you, I was beating myself with sackcloth and everything yesterday. I'm Megan. I work at Environmental Defense Fund on the Climate and Clean Air team. And when we are hiring, it's maybe slightly different because I'm at an environmental advocacy nonprofit, and that's what we do, right? So I look for somebody who cares deeply, really, really deeply, because sometimes the hours are long and the work is hard and it is stressful and it doesn't pay like some of these other pathways pay. And so you want someone who is going to be as driven as the rest of the team by sort of making that difference. So I look for passion. I look for passion that is tempered a little bit by pragmatism, because we don't always get the outcomes that we so desperately want, and sort of being able to think pragmatically about how are we really going to get there and how are we going to get results is really important to me, in addition to some of the things that everybody else has been highlighting in terms of, you know, somebody who's really smart, really thoughtful, really thinks about things clearly and objectively, I was joking with Vicki, my boss, the other day. I was like, do you want, you just want me not to do any real work at all? She's like, no, you don't have time for that anymore. I'm like, okay. So like I'm really relying on the folks who are around me, who are doing the really core legal thinking and analysis. And I need to know that when they're giving it to me straight, right? Because I mean, we're then going to make an advocacy product out of it because we're advocates and that's what we do. But I need to know that I am getting the pros and the cons and the weaknesses and the strengths and a broad picture, and I need to know that people are being comprehensive and thorough and thinking about things really hard, and then I look for people who can do some of that creative thinking when they're doing the hard legal work and thinking about solutions and are hopefully going to think about things differently than I think about them, because then that's going to add to the team dynamic and we're going to get to a much better place. David knows, I mean, I have a fairly strong personality, so I look for people who are going to challenge me on things, right? Who are, you know, that whether they're quiet, I don't need them not to be quiet. My current legal fellow is brilliant and amazing and one of the quietest people I've ever been around. But he will tell me when he thinks I'm wrong, and he will tell me when he's got a different perspective on things, and I absolutely need that. And it needs to be respectful and thoughtful and not about, you know, proving someone wrong. It needs to be about getting to the right outcome. So I also look for a little bit of humility, but confidence at the same time. And then to the Cleveland airport flight to China, et cetera, point, I look for a sense of humor. You don't necessarily have to crack jokes. You probably have to laugh at mine a little bit, or at least not look at me like I've grown a third head when I'm cracking them on a daily basis. So, you know, somebody who's going to be a fun, warm, you know, personality in the office and going to work hard and be able to take, I think the ability to take constructive criticism is significantly undervalued in sort of general talking about skills that one should develop. And I am not a paragon of virtue in this respect whatsoever, but I have worked with legal fellows who have just been amazing at being like, oh, okay. And then just implemented, like just went after whatever feedback they were given and implemented it. And it's one of the first things I tell people when they call me about these folks, about new jobs. I say, you know, this is something you should know about this person. Extraordinarily good at taking constructive criticism and executing it. And, you know, there's no ego involved. It's just sort of how can I be better at doing my job? And I think that's a hugely important asset. And it's something to try to make sure it's reflected on your resume and in conversations when you're interviewing as well.
Other questions? All right, we have a question from one of our callers that was emailed in. What advice do you have for a French-American citizen with an LLM and NY Bar admission to start a career in environmental law in the U.S.?
World Bank. That's what I have. It's a hard one.
That's an awfully specific one.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I get back to my, you know, for anything, like, you apply broadly, you do those sorts of things, but then if it gets down to it and there's a type of job that you want, just go there and offer your services. I mean, if you have any financial cushion, or then that sort of tactic, like, you know, if you're good and if you're the type of person that they want or another organization wants, that gets you in the door. And once that happens, you know, you're set. That being said, that is scary, and I admire people that are able to do that.
But I totally agree with David. I think it's one of the most effective things you can do if you can manage to do it. I've hired two people who came in off the street to volunteer, and they were tremendous, and we gave them jobs.
Yeah. I might also say, with that kind of background in Paris coming up next year, I would maybe try to identify people that would be players at Paris and just relentlessly email them and get coffee and get to know them and talk a little bit about what they do and how they got there. We're in Washington. Everybody loves talking about this stuff. And I'd say get a sense from that, from people that are thinking at some small part of their brain about Paris. But to just start building a network, and if you can volunteer, even a Hill internship or a fellowship or something like that can open way more doors than you would think. Mm-hmm. And is something that is a total financial pain that can be mitigated later.
And Patrick, for the crowd. And by crowd, what is Paris exactly?
Oh, in 2015 will be the next conference of the parties for the what we all hope will be an effective UN agreement on climate change. And this is, you know, you hear like Kyoto, things like that. Paris is the next one you're going to hear. And there's a lot of hope built up for it, especially with the U.S. doing rules and China announcing a potential cap and trade system this week. And it's going to be a very, you know, at least in the near term, medium term, very hot area for climate and environmental law.
I would say also network. That's huge. I mean, you want to, if we don't know who you are, we can't help you. Or it can't bring you in, or it won't try to recruit you. For instance, I mean, get involved in bar organizations, whether it's the ABA, go to ELI events such as the ones today. You meet people who may know other people or know of openings. If you're in DC, there's events on the Hill, National Geographic has events. Just get involved, whether or not it's the DC bar, New York bar, and just attend events, meet people, get your name out there. I mean, get your card out there, email people, do coffee, do lunch. I mean, I, I've I know a number of people who have gotten job offers by just networking, meeting people, and doing lunch with them, doing coffee with them, and staying in contact. And then something opens up, and they remember you. They remember your face and say, hey, this position just opened up. You should apply for it. Or we're looking for this. Are you still open or interested? I think, I mean, if people don't know who you are, they can't help you. So getting out there, meeting people, and networking is also important.
What advice would you give to those of us who are still in undergrad? Specifically, would you advise someone considering law school to avoid going straight into law school and maybe get real world experience?
So the question is, what advice would you give to a current undergraduate student who's considering law school?
Oh, God, are you sure?
There's still so much hope.
Well, no, I think that the hopeful way to say that is... I heard that a lot coming out, too, because I had a science background. Think of the job that would make you fulfilled and happy, like, and the job that you want. And if you can answer that question, then law school is great for you. Like, if you need a law degree to do that job, I think a lot of people go into law school, and you know, for smart people, it's the next easiest step because you don't really need to do much. I mean, you study for the LSAT for a little bit, and then you go to law school. So if there's a dream job that requires a law degree, think about that. And then once you do it, always like write yourself a note before you. I'm like that serious about that, and make sure that your decisions are directed to that. Because I think the biggest problem that I saw among my best friends in law school, and especially those that were doing their dual degree, is that you just got caught up in this inertia where you might think you're doing one thing when you come in, and by the time you leave, you're doing something very different. You're doing what the group does. And so to really be motivated by whatever passion drives you to law school, and if you can't answer that question of whatever that the perfect job is, even it doesn't have to be specific. You don't have to say, I want to be Megan Sharansky, though I would have said that probably. you just need to know, have a good feel for it, and then follow that passion with every decision you make, because it is a professional school. Like, you know, you're not going to, some of it's intellectual development, but a lot of it is you want every decision to be directed towards that end goal. Answer that question and then follow it. Go for it.
And I agree with that, certainly to an extent. Sometimes law school can open up other things you just had no idea were on the radar. Like, I really enjoyed tax law, and told that's more common than you might think before coming in. But in all seriousness, I think you benefit tremendously by having some experience prior to law school that justifies your decision to go. And for many in D.C., that might mean a position on the Hill or working for an organization like ELI or EDF or others that are in that field to get a sense for what it really looks like. I think it's an awfully big commitment to make in terms of time out of your life, effort expended, opportunity cost, and straight up cost. We may have lost our
phone line. I think we lost the conference call, yeah.
Hopefully that's not a metaphor for anything.
Yeah. But, long story short, it's a really big decision. So knowing that when you get to an organization like ELI, like EDF, like BND, V&E, usually referred to as DDP, loving the acronyms, GE, that you have some idea that's not sort of overbuilt in your head about what it's going to look like when you get there. There's a lot of stuff that's not glamorous, fun, or seemingly productive that goes into a legal career, and getting a sense for what that looks like is important.
So just to talk about the nasty stuff, so I have $170,000 in student loans from undergrad and graduate school, and that's a lot of money, and I'm certainly not going to be paying that off, but you know, you research. There's a bright thing to the start. But you know, there, before you go, know what your options are. So, you know, if you work at a public interest organization for 10, so my school repays my loans, and then if you work at a public interest organization for 10 years, theoretically they'll be forgiven after that. So that isn't, it's something I need to consider, and I'm probably not going to be buying a house in that time, but it's not the end of the world, but to know what financial obligations you're incurring and what that means to you. I think it's like, and in something like this, you can't talk about it without talking about the finances. And that's what ends up motivating a lot of people's decisions is that, you know, if you're making $160,000 a year out of law school, it's very easy to repay that within a few years. But if that's not what you want to do, you're probably going to end up, I mean, most people end up staying there. So know your options with loans and that sort of thing. And don't be afraid of them. You know, if you want to get in the public interest, there's a lot of different options. But to also just know that the perfect world doesn't always transpire, and you might end up doing something you don't like if you don't consider that.
And I think to build off that point, especially for if you're still an undergraduate, it's worth asking yourself if you really want to be a lawyer. I think people who have not started the law school application process sometimes think that a JD is more versatile than it is, right? Oh, I want to do policy, so I should go to law school. For some people, that's great, but really, you should go to law school if you want to be a lawyer. If you want to do policy, there are many other graduate school options that may be better for what you want to do. And also, quite honestly, if after that you decide you want to go to law school, I've never seen or heard of a law school that would look down upon the fact that you went and got another graduate degree, a master's, or something else first.
I asked the same question when I was an undergrad, and at the time I was interning at Nike out in Oregon, and I had a mentor who was an attorney. She had also had a chemical engineering background, then went to law school, and her advice was to take a year or two in between. She said she took a year in between undergrad and law school and studied, went abroad in China and worked in China for a year, and she said it was the best experience of her life. She said she went over there, and that was the one time in her life where she was able to do that. I mean, she figured, you know, you go through law school, and once you start your legal career, you're going to be working pretty much full time. I mean, to pay off the loans or whatever else you have to do. But I mean, it's the one chance you have to kind of do things. Two, I would also say that it's also an opportunity to really figure out if you want to be a lawyer. As was already mentioned, it's a huge investment. I mean, time is 3 years, four if you're going part time. It's very expensive. So you want to make sure it's what you want to do. I took a year and I worked at the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office where I was around attorneys, initially had some interest in patent law at the time, but I was able to get some experience and see if this is what I wanted to do. Could I see myself practicing law forever? Another reason is that law school is competitive, so you want to make sure you know that you want to go. I mean, first year, a lot of times your job prospects hinge off of how well you do your first year. So once you get in, it's very competitive. So you want to make sure you want to be there. This is what you want to do, because once you start day one, it's a full go. So there are a number of reasons. And I know when we're hiring, you know, we definitely don't frown upon someone who's worked for a few years and has experience. We look at it as an asset. I mean, someone who's been in the field, who understands industry, who has worked, and you have a chance to grow and figure out what you really want to do, because, like I said, it's a huge investment, and you want to make sure that that's what you want to do and where you want to be.
Just a couple of notes to add to that. I usually do, the first time undergrads ask me, I usually tell them don't go. Not because I don't think it makes sense for some people, I think a lot of people end up going for whom it doesn't actually make sense. And like David, my colleagues, both in law school and now from law school, the ones who are unhappy are the ones who weren't quite sure why they were going to law school when they went, and now they're not quite sure why they went or what they want to do. I, on the other hand, knew exactly why I was going. I wanted to do environmental advocacy, and I honestly was pretty sure that I wouldn't really use my law degree once I got into the policy space. But I had worked in D.C., and everyone around me who was doing policy had a law degree. And D.C., and this happens to some degree at the state level, although less, in D.C., there's this weird thing where if you're having some conversations about, you know, what are we going to do with this piece of legislation, or what are we going to do with this, you know, regulation interpreting this piece of legislation, if you're not a lawyer, you don't really get to have an opinion because it's a legal question, right? I mean, this stuff is not rocket science. So like, the fact that that is true is a little bit ridiculous for people who have been around these particular statutes for decades and know definitely what they're talking about. But that does happen in D.C. So I went to law school, and now I find myself doing a lot of law, as it turns out, because there is this aspect of environmental advocacy where you are figuring out what is possible to do within this regulatory space, and what could we do with new legislation, and how would we draft it, and how do we, and I mean, I'm doing law plus economics plus politics plus, you know, psychological strategy, but you know, like plus all of these different things. But there is a significant law component, so that's been great. But I have a lot of friends who went, and you know, some of my friends who ended up in corporate law firms love it, right? Like they actually love the corporate practice of law. And so they're very happy. Other friends ended up in corporate law firms and found out that they were not interested in doing that work. And so they have left. And many of them haven't figured out what it is that they do actually want to do. So getting a real sense of what it is within environmental law that you're interested in, and actually getting a real sense of like what it looks like by taking some time off beforehand and trying to get some exposure, super helpful. It also means that when you get into the competitive, weird world of law school, which can be a ton of fun or a ton of misery, you have a bit more perspective because you have done other things. You haven't just come straight from undergrad where that world becomes your sort of only perspective. I think it's very helpful to have had a bit of a sense of the outside world first, and then you can have more fun, honestly, while you're in law school because you don't get quite as sucked up into some of the stuff. So,
yeah, anecdotally, at Duke, almost the most successful people almost all took time off, like across the board, which I thought was really interesting. As someone that went straight through from undergrad, she probably shouldn't, but no, so as someone that went straight through, I thought it was really interesting that most of the people were probably 28 that were really successful, I mean, by the time they graduated or more, or in their 30s. That was really interesting.
Yeah, we had a bimodal distribution, I think, that
it's sort of the K through JD, and then we have the folks that are work.
The K through JD. Oh, God, that's horrifying.
had taken a little bit of time and you know, worked in some job that they either liked or didn't like, and decided to make a switch very purposefully into law, and they tended to do a little bit better, I think.
All right, another question from the phone. How did you find your jobs, and what resources would you recommend for job searching?
So ELI has a job listing so you should be a part, should be a member of ELI, because that's honestly like one of the best places to look.
It is a good job listing site.
Yeah, and then other than that, just be on the lookout for everything. There's a bunch of different resources out there that if the person over the phone has, you know, that you can usually find through career offices or other places. But that's the best way to find them. And then I think in terms of how you find your jobs, I mean, I can't speak for public interest organizations. It's a pretty closed universe. You know who they are, you know when they're hiring, and you go after that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lot different for law firms.
I found my job through networking. I was here for a period clerking at EPA as a law clerk, and ended up meeting someone from Beveridge and Diamond, a partner at Beveridge and Diamond. And at the time, it was during the period where a lot of law firms had hiring freezes. I mean, Beveridge and Diamond didn't have a class for 2 years at the time. But I stayed in contact. I ended up going to a conference that was actually in New Orleans where I was in law school at the time, and the partner invited me to come and join him for lunch one day and to come to a panel or two with him. So I went, and then later on that fall, he kept me in mind and said, hey, we're lifting our hiring freeze. Would you be interested in coming to B&D? You should apply. And I applied and went through the interviewing phase and ended up getting an offer. So it comes through, as I mentioned earlier, through meeting people, networking, and going to bar organization events, going to panels such as these panels here, and meeting people. That's how I ended up meeting my contact, and then it worked out down the road where I was able to get an offer.
So my first job out of law school was clerking on the Fourth Circuit, and I got that job because my judge had been invited to come to my law school and give a talk, and I was hosting the lunch for him, and we got into an argument about, what was it about? Oh, it was about the last Wellstone Senate campaign. He made a joke about it that I did not appreciate, and I challenged him on it. As it turns out, we got along great, and so that's how I ended up with my clerkship. And then I went to Van Ness Feldman, and I got that job just to emphasize the importance of like talking to people, because I was doing a summer internship at Environmental Defense Fund. And the ex-wife of my supervisor is also in the environmental law and policy field. And my supervisor was like, you should really have lunch with my ex-wife. You know, she's great. And so he set that up, and we had this wonderful lunch. And she was like, have you thought about Van Ness Feldman? You know, talk to Kyle Danish. And so I don't know, she sent Kyle an email or I sent Kyle an email and we like, you know, had lunch. That became my introductory interview. I summered there the next summer. I then went there after I clerked. And then I got the job at EDF. When I interned there, I interned for the policy team because folks were actually doing climate legislation back then, and not for the legal team. So when I was at Van Ness and looking to switch over more into the straight up policy advocacy space, this same ex-wife was like, "I think EDF is hiring." I was like, "Really? I didn't know that." Anyway, so I sent in my application. Turns out one of my best friends from law school had interned for my new boss while he was in law school. So he put in a good word for me that she trusted, and that, you know, made a huge difference. So, like, you know, genuine connections with people, getting to know the people who are doing interesting work makes a huge difference.
Yeah. If this sounds like a strange scenario to you, it's really not. Mm-hmm. It's really not a strange one. Quick sidebar, Wellstone, are you a Wellstone person?
Yes.
Native Minnesotan?
Yes.
Good for you. Grew up in Minneapolis.
Excellent.
Also a big Wellstone supporter.
Excellent.
It truly is a wonderful place. I highly commend it.
Yeah, move to Minnesota. This is our advice for you today.
Yeah.
That's true.
It's great. Boundary waters.
With climate change, the winters are getting pretty wimpy.
But it's far from the coast, so keep it in mind. I think, yeah, you got to build those networks, absolutely, because this isn't a large town, and this is especially not a large field. You all in this room, and we all in this room, will see each other who knows how many times over the next 5-10 years, constantly, and in ways you don't anticipate. So you get to know people and you kind of face to a name and sit down with people, and it leads to one thing and another and another. And you know, our company has this big bureaucratic, almost government-like application process, but it still depends a little bit on relationships and taking the time to at least say, well, should I reach out to my network, see if somebody knows somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody at GE, and could they say a word on my behalf, and basically drink coffee until you connect point A and point B, and put a face to name again.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, my current job, I was recruited because of somebody I knew, and, you know, that's kind of how it happened. And my last job with the nonprofit, I knew I wanted to go the nonprofit route at that point, so it was following all their websites and seeing who was hiring. And I think I got that job. I joke all the time. I'm really good friends with my old boss. I joke all the time I got the job because I'm a hockey fan. And I was asked the question, something about you that's not on here, and we started talking hockey, and we clicked. So I joke all the time that, you know, I got it because of hockey. So that goes along the lines of the personality and fitting in. So, but yeah, it's a lot of networking. Networking is a lot more important than most people think it is. So.
And code word, if you don't like networking, just being friendly.
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah. It is not that hard to tell the difference between obnoxious networking and, like,
right.
Genuine, we have a shared common interest, could we talk about it for a little while? So,
and that's go for it. Don't be afraid to reach out to somebody and say, could I meet you for coffee? I mean, a lot of people are intimidated by that. Don't be intimidated by it.
People almost never, I mean, people want to help any way they can, and they'll almost never say no.
I've never said no to anybody.
Yeah.
And, like, even pretty high up people.
No.
Yeah.
Another question in the room? All right, I have another question from the phone. What is the accomplishment you are most proud of?
I don't know how any of us got jobs. He was recruiting, not that good at interviewing.
I'll start off again. For me, I think, well, within the past 3 years of practicing law, I think it would be the pro bono work that I've done. Whether it's with the Whitman Walker Clinic, assisting their clients with wills, then also working with another organization called SAFE, doing domestic violence work there, and also with the DC Bar doing landlord-tenant matters. I think giving back to the community and you know, using your skills that you learned through law school and in practice to help people in the community, those who may not have the funds to help themselves. I think for me, that feeling makes you feel very accomplished, and it makes you feel great just to be able to help someone else and put a smile on someone else's face who, without your assistance, you don't know where they would be, out their home or just in a bad situation. So I think just being able to help the community and using your skills to help people, I think that's one of my biggest accomplishments over the past 3 years.
Yeah, I think for me, some of mine would be some of the work I did when I was at the nonprofit. And that was just it, getting involved in some of the smaller community cases, or when you really start to look at it, should this development really happen or something like that? Should this power plant really go in? And when you really start to look at the issues, you feel pretty good about yourself at the end of the day if you've either stopped a big polluter or, helped where the polluter puts on big controls or something like that, that really has an impact on the people who live there. So, yeah.
Yeah. Oddly enough, pro bono, like, in a weird way, in that it's not quite related to environmental law in my portfolio, but one of the things I'm proud of is being able to take the skill set developed on environmental law issues, admin law issues, and apply it to healthcare matter. With our company that had to deal with reimbursement for laboratory tests. We, for whatever reason, own a lab in California that does sort of next generation genetic testing. And it's so you can receive drugs like Tarceva or others that are important, that if you respond to it, it's a game changer in stage 4 cancer. And something that's threatened so existentially by regulation and by how much these tests are reimbursed for. And taking that skill set and applying it over and trying to promote, it's for a business, it's not necessarily for a pro bono client. But it's still something I felt good about, and it's still nice to be able to take some of the learning from the job and take it more broadly.
So that talked about, I'm gonna do a very stupid story, but it has a theme, I guess. So I was down in the Gulf at this, it's a retreat of different communities, and what they did, I saw icebreakers on the schedule. I was like, yeah, icebreakers are fun. And of course, they bring out the music, and it's like dancing time. And that to me is like my ultimate horrible dancer. But jumped in and tried, and there's this woman that we're one of our partners down there who's a very prominent community leader who like picked me up and did two steps. I was like, oh, I can't dance. She's like, anyone can dance. And she's like, so we danced for a few minutes, and she, no, you can't dance. But the theme of this, and it kind of gets back to what I think I'm most proud of, is that I did jump in and tried and went for it. And I think with my legal career, that's been the biggest thing that I'm proud of, is that when you want something or when there's a goal that you have, just go for it. Because really, like, what's the worst that can happen? I mean, there's... You have to take risks. You're gonna screw up. You're gonna fail a ton, no matter how high you get, and just not to be scared of that, and to really, like, I knew I wanted to do public interest law, so took a lot of risks and went for it, and didn't do some other things that would have been easier and more profitable. But that doesn't mean that those are bad decisions. But it wouldn't have been right for me. And to do that with anything, just go for it.
So I'll go in the exact opposite direction, and the word accomplishment is a bit of a stretch, but I will say the two things that I have been associated with that I am the most proud of.
You're a good dancer.
Exactly. I am actually a fairly good dancer. Anyway, one, last fall, the Supreme Court refused to hear the challenges to EPA's finding that greenhouse gas emissions endanger public health and welfare. I was responsible for on the brief that was defending the endangerment finding from the NGO and state side. And we got a great decision out of the D.C. Circuit upholding that finding and sort of laughing off the challenges, basically. And then the Supreme Court refused to take it, and that's the foundation for controlling greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act going forward. So that was a huge, huge moment. And then on Monday, as pretty much as a direct result of all of that, the president and EPA put forward their proposal to address greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants, which I've been working on for 3 years. And so that was a huge step forward. There's a ton of work still to be done, but these are the kinds of transformative moments you hope you're around in your career. So it's been very, very exciting.
To my nerdy world, and like people, she's like a celebrity. her team. But
Question. There's no paparazzi, trust me.
Hi, so this question is primarily to Patrick and Amy, but I'd like to open it up to anyone else on the panel who feels free. It's about sort of forward-looking, looking ahead, as to what do you think are the next issues that are coming up that you would encourage students to maybe target their practice or their education towards? And why I'm speaking particularly to Patrick and Amy is because of your comments about the energy sector. So we know capacity in the energy sector, is it expected to grow 30%+ over the next 20 or so years to meet the needs of our growing country and even global? And so that's going to, I assume, bring with it regulatory and legislative issues. So we could assume that there's going to be a growth in that part of the sector and the legal implications of that. Are there other growth opportunities that you see in the environmental space that you would actually encourage students to look at?
So the question, for those of you on the phone, the question is, what are future areas of growth that law students might want to focus on in their studies?
I'm probably less qualified to read the tea leaves on this than you are, but I'd say you kind of nailed it, I think, on the energy side of this. I always look at energy and environment like two sides of the same coin. If you look at the breakdown of greenhouse gas emissions in the country, for instance, 40% of the emissions, roughly speaking, come from generating electricity, 40% cars, and 20% other. But it's very clear at this point that where we're at now is not where we're going to be able to be privileged to be at in 20 or 30 years. And there's a couple shots across the bow, policy-wise, like the German Energiewende, where they just said, no nuke. and they're building coal plants. And they're seeing what happens when you start impinging parts of a complex system. But it's incredibly complex. And when you start hitting states issues in the U.S., and you hit the grid and PJM, where we sit, mm-hmm. and you hit all these different producers of power and how they operate and how they're regulated, and how they expect to make money and continue to exist, and what do they owe their ratepayers, what do they owe their stockholders, you get into this whole set of issues that is not simple, is not a short-term solution, and it's something where we're going to start dealing with it because we're going to start impinging the coal plants on the grid. And to a certain extent, the new plants as well face into some headwinds with how they're financed and operated. But really, we have kind of like a step one, step two thing. I think there's other issues there as well, but we have seen tremendous success from the Clean Air Act in reducing things like criteria pollutants. I think there's an old Frank Zappa album with Los Angeles on it from like the 60s or 70s, got Yellow Air. And if you go to Los Angeles, I don't think anybody would hold that up as like the paragon of clean air in the country, but it's dramatically better. And even in areas like D.C., we're dealing primarily with car issues.
Yeah. Most of our pollution comes from mobile sources, cars.
Which this does surprise
me. And then from everybody else.
Exactly.
From all the Midwest,
all the upwind states.
Right. So how do you take this amazing
And that
document?
One coal plant in the Senate.
That's right. But you got this document from 1791 that we have to somehow kind of adapt to this problem of, smog coming in from Pennsylvania and other, sort of upwind states and all that. But I guess what do you think?
Energy, I think, is big, and it goes along with the Clean Air Act. I mean, the Clean Air Act is not going anywhere, and there's a lot more to do. Energy, as far as the energy side, fracking is a huge issue, and it's not going away. I mean, we're starting to get into deeper shale plays. That's going to be around a while. There's a lot of issues with fracking right now where they're exempt from a lot of things, especially under the Clean Air Act. That could possibly change. And I think looking at, the sustainability aspect of things and looking at the alternative fuel sources and, sustainable energy sources, wind and solar, I mean, that's all going to have to start coming into a bigger play once you start cracking down on the coal plants and gas and things of that nature. So I think that's a really big area that needs to, be looked at and would be worthwhile, to get some experience in.
Yeah. I actually might add on to that sustainability, which is kind of the theme there. It's not just a buzzword. You have to, if you're a manufacturing company especially, you have to look at a world where you don't have cheap coal to produce your electricity, and what does that impact in your manufacturing base? So there is a lot of advising that'll take place in the companies like mine and others sort of similarly situated around the world. that are making stuff and shipping stuff and, you know, using stuff and dealing with those issues?
I think that was a great question. You always want to constantly look forward as to what issues are going to arise down the road. You know, you can become an expert in the issue and become a leader on that issue. Just to echo what Amy said about, you know, dealing with the Clean Air Act, as the energy sector grows, there's still going to be a need for the traditional environmental laws. There's going to be Clean Water Act issues, Clean Air Act issues, hazardous waste issues, as the energy sector grows, especially here within the states. Also international law, I think that's going to be, it's going to continue to grow. International environmental law is going to continue to grow. As you notice, the U.S. is trying to become less dependent on foreign resources. But at the same time, down the road, we may also look at exporting our resources. How do we do that? What international issues are you going to have to deal with? Whether it's ocean issues or whether it's issues in various countries, I think identifying those you know, issues that are going to arise down the road could be very important. Also, as they mentioned, as far as with alternative energy, wind, solar, turbines, you're dealing with endangered species issues. You know, they have birds, they get trapped in the wind turbines. I mean, dealing with those issues as well. So there are a lot of different issues that all the traditional environmental laws are going to continue to be around. But as the energy industry grows, how do the traditional environmental laws interact with those, the new developments of the, you know, with fracking or with, you know, solar energy and with renewable energy sources?
So to take a slightly broader perspective, I think that if you were to talk to anybody who's been practicing law for, you know, 15, 20 or more years, especially in the private sector, but I suspect this is true everywhere, they will tell you that they have to reinvent themselves and reinvent their practice every 5 to 10 years, right? So they're not doing the things now that they did when they got out of law school. None of us will be doing the same things we're doing now in 5 or 10 years. So I think when you're in law school, you know, you don't have to choose the thing you're going to do forever, because that's not going to be the thing you're going to do forever. What I see in my practice is that the practice of law, not just environmental law, all law, is becoming a lot more interdisciplinary. So if energy is something you're interested in, study energy, but know something that's not the law. If your school gives you the chance to take classes in something other than the law school, do it. Okay, question from the phone. I understand that different parts of environmental law are siloed, so meaning that people are water lawyers or air lawyers or waste lawyers. What efforts are you seeing to create integration across these silos, and what skills can the next generation bring to these efforts?
So I don't have any background in firm work, but this Monday and Tuesday, I was at our board meeting, which is the managing partner of Brandon's firm, for example. And what they all said is that these silos really don't exist that much anymore. If you're a lawyer, you kind of got to deal with everything. Like, there's no such thing as a CERCLA lawyer, or, you know, which is the Superfund, that sort of thing. It's all breaking down. So just to be comfortable thinking on your feet, be flexible, that sort of thing. I mean, I imagine that you guys, you work on everything, right?
I started out as mostly a water lawyer. That's what my background is mostly water law. But as you reinvent yourself, you start to work on more and more issues. And I think that we are getting more multimedia. I know in my office, several of the attorneys that have been there for a while kind of focus on one thing and don't necessarily want to, you know, try something different. But I know a lot of the younger attorneys, the newer attorneys, they want to do everything, and I'm happy for that. I mean, I'm more than willing to assign them different cases so that they're not pigeonholed into one specific thing, because I just think it makes you more marketable later on. I definitely think it's better to go the multimedia route. You definitely need to be an expert in something, but yet you need to be able to kind of articulate yourself across the board and, you know, take on new challenges.
You know, we, as an example, debating whether I should air this out, but one of our lawyers in GE Aviation, we had a cooling water issue. He's an airhead, and cooling water intake structures are water law, just straight up. And he's going crazy. He's like, why can't you just permit these at how much you're going to use them? And he's like, why don't they do it like the Clean Air Act? So, well, different statute, and the concepts don't always port over. But actually, to a large extent, they do. And there's a lot of overlap in concept and how the agency does approach things that you can use effectively in a practice if you cross statute around them. And I I get the sense, and I don't know if folks from EPA would confirm this or not, that agency has felt increasingly integrated in its approach to environmental law. I mean, it used to be sort of a conglomeration of statutes, from my understanding, but yeah, that seems to be the case. And in the policy world, you can't really afford not to be a polymath about it, because it's just, you know, we're too leanly staffed, for instance, to not be able to at least pick up the book and read through the next statute that you have to deal with.
Yeah, I agree. I think at Beverage and Diamond, we have, we do it all, but we have experts in different areas. For instance, you know, we have someone that does RCRA and hazardous waste and has been doing it since the statute came up. I mean, they've been doing it since the 80s, and they know it. And clients come to us because they want someone that's an expert in RCRA. Same with the Clean Air Act. We have a partner who knows the Clean Air Act like the back of his hand. Same with the Clean Water Act. So we have experts in different areas, and I find that beneficial as well, because a lot of clients come to us for those specific issues, dealing with the Clean Air Act or Clean Water Act or Hazardous Waste, Endangered Species Act. And you find that those experts are useful in different areas, different practices. For instance, with litigation, if we're dealing with a Clean Water Act litigation matter, we'll bring that partner in because they know the Clean Water Act and they know the ins and outs of it. But also they can be useful in a transactional matter or in a regulatory matter because they know the statute. And so I find it beneficial to have an expert, you know, to be an expert in a certain area. But as a junior associate, I think it's important to get exposure to the different areas, because you don't know what you like, and you won't know unless you try it. When I was at EPA, I did RCRA the entire time, and Subtitle C of RCRA, which was great. I enjoyed it, but that's all I did. At BND, they want the associates to get exposure in different areas, whether it's I've done Clean Water Act matters, Clean Air Act matters, toxic tort matters, CERCLA matters, Superfund and hazardous waste matters. And so you get a chance to try different things to see what you like. But you know, you don't have to make a decision. I mean, you can, you know, have experience in all different areas, and that can be useful as well. But also being an expert, people will come to you for that specific area. So if you want to become an expert in an area, it can be beneficial for your career.
I think to be in the enforcement world, I think to be a little more multimedia, you can also help your enforcement and your inspectors. You know, a lot of inspectors, for instance, only do one thing. They only deal with air issues or hazardous waste. But then when they bring you the case and you start looking at it, you go, well, wait a minute. You might have, you know, had all these, you know, fugitive dust emissions that you hosed down, but you hosed it down a storm drain. So now you've got a water issue to deal with. And so, you know, I think that by at least understanding some of the other issues, you can help, you know, and it's a compliance issue at that point. And then you can help, you know, the regulated community understand that there's more than just this one issue they need to deal with, so.
Okay, we have time for one more question. Does anybody in the room have one? All right, I will ask you guys the last question. If you could go back to the first day of your legal career and give yourself one piece of advice, what would it be?
To relax. I got a lot of anxiety the first day walking in. You have all of these people who've been practicing for years, and you're fresh out of law school, and you know, just to relax and you know, understand that you don't know everything, that you're still learning, and as was mentioned earlier, you're going to learn every day. Just to relax, they know you don't know everything. You're there, you're going to learn it, and to relax and, you know, one, enjoy what you do, and make the most out of that opportunity, and just work hard.
Mine would be to enjoy what you do, and if you don't enjoy it, find something different. Because, you know, you have to go to that office every day, and you have to do that job every day, so you want to enjoy it. And it can be a lot of fun when you enjoy it.
I'd say be open-minded to where your feet might be pointing in a direction you're not paying attention to sometimes, but be open to making a switch out of what works. Don't assume because you like something in law school that that's the type of lawyer that you have to become.
I think that would be it.
David, you're skipping.
Skipping, deferring.
David's deferring. God, that's a tough question. I don't know. I don't think I can improve on the answers that have been given. I do think it's really important to enjoy what you do, and most of us have the luxury of finding something that we can enjoy, and that's, I think, not to be taken for granted. And So figuring out what that is, and there's a huge value to doing it and having a job that may make you want to tear your hair out at the end of the day, but it's because you care and it's because you, you know, are invested rather than because you're bored to death.
You know, work's a part of life, like, and not to view it in two separate silos unless you want to be miserable forever, even if you like your job. But just to view it that way and try to, you know, make the decisions that make you happy, and don't view when you're young as like a means to an end, because I hope it's not, and that'd be weird. So just view it as part of life.
Well, thank you all. Please join me in thanking our panelists.